Welcome back. It's a Monday, the fourth day of March, 2019. I'm your host, Mark Hall, and it's another one of those Mondays where we start off with a reminder, actually a lot of reminders, of just how far gone things are, especially when it comes to freedom in the formerly free United States of America, once even known as a republic, now just spelled with a K. It was also the weekend where Donald Trump made the longest speech of his presidency, clocking in at just over 2 hours, at CPAC, or the Conservative Political Action Committee, where even the press coverage by the fake waste stream media made the same point. So let's start off our look today with another one of those illustrative stories that makes a similar point, at least in an entirely different way. One of the leading contenders for the lowest IQ perhaps ever in the House of Representatives, and that's saying a lot, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, says a piece I saw up on a site called LibertyUnyielding.com, but originally via Ryan Saavedra in the Daily Wire, faced backlash, and it's about time, after she came to the defense of fellow far-left nutcase, as well as Constitution, Rule of Law, and USA-hating Rashida Tlaib, Sharia Party rep from Michigan, on Twitter, following racist remarks that the latter made during a House Oversight Committee hearing. Seems like of late it's getting hard to know which non-Muslim group she hates the most. Where Tlaib falsely suggested that Representative Mark Meadows, could it be because he was a white male, was in fact a racist when Mark Meadows brought a Trump official named Lynn Patton to last week's Michael Cohen test-a-lying circus. Here's what the racist in reverse said to Meadows. Quote, just because someone has a person of color, a black person working for them, doesn't mean they aren't racist. The fact that someone would actually use a prop, a black woman in this chamber, in this committee, is alone racist in itself, unquote. Prompting the occasional Cortex to respond with the usual low IQ knee-jerk tweet saying, total bravery from at Rashida Tlaib as she reminds the nation that tokenism asterisk is asterisk racism, unquote, and booga booga booga, which was no sale to even most of those with below average intelligence, because just assuming that any woman of color is too stupid to know what she wants and she's being used as a token so that at least one representative observer is also racist. You know what, folks? Everything anymore that anybody says when they open their mouth is racist, racist, racist. That is, if they are of the appropriate fill-in-the-blank race, color, creed, or sexual orientation. Give me a break. And as the Liberty Unyielding editor puts it, there's simply no winning with these leftist nutcases. If you have no blacks on your staff, you're guilty of racism. But if you have blacks on your staff, you're guilty of tokenism, which is also racism. So hey, heads I win, tails you lose, and you can't win. Well, unless, obviously, you're far enough left that you're not guilty of anything. Even high crimes, misdemeanors, and treason, as we now know. I do think, when all is said and done, that it's very appropriate to allow the woman who was accused by a racist of being a prop to speak for herself. Lynn Patton tweeted, quote, I'd like to ask the congresswoman from Michigan, why does she take the word of a self-confessed perjurer and a criminally convicted white man over a black female who is highly educated, rose up through the ranks of one of the most competitive companies in real estate, spoke before 25 million people at the Republican National Convention, and now works at one of the most historic administrations in history? To me, that would be my question. That's more racist than being put up there as a, quote, unquote, prop. She also had a problem with the assumption, implied in all of that, that a black woman can't think for herself, so she must be a prop, or in assuming that a black woman isn't accomplished enough to be in attendance alongside other lawmakers on their own merit. She pointed out that she was only there because she dared to defy the liberal narrative. Period. And quote, the only prop in that room was Michael Cohen for the Democrat Party. God forbid I was there because I actually know the President of the United States and have an established opinion of my own. What's more racist? Thank you, she said, Democrats, for proving to the American people that your party clearly thinks it's both. Unquote. And hear, hear, Lynn. This country's not going to be able to rise from the wreckage that is political correctness until it's finally able to recognize pure evil for what it is and has the courage to speak up about it. And I guess while we're more or less on the subject of the test-a-liar, this is appropriate. That very same Lynn Patton, who works at the Department of Housing and Urban Development under Ben Carson, they're going to call him a token too? knows the answer to the question of why it would be that Donald Trump's former personal attorney, Michael Cohen, would so totally turn on him and attempt to blindside the president. Oh, and that also may help to explain the racist bait-and-switch subterfuge here. Patton noted in a Facebook post that it did, in fact, involve a lengthy prison sentence threat, but not for Cohen. Quote, "What many of you may not be aware of is the fact that I can personally confirm that the only reason Michael Cohen turned on the President of the United States is because Mueller threatened to throw his wife in jail for up to 30 years, period. She's the co-guarantor of a $20 million personal loan that Mueller discovered Michael secured back in 2015 by falsely inflating the value of his taxi medallions, effectively making her part and parcel to the federal charge of, quote, making false statements to a financial institution." Oh, which is different, folks, than making false statements if you're a financial institution. And that's what Cohen ultimately pled guilty to. And this, says Patton, is also the reason why Cohen's longtime taxi medallion partner, Evgeny Gene Friedman, was granted immunity. So I guess we know Michael Cohen's not only a crooked lawyer and a perjurer, but maybe this is the only good thing you can say about the guy. At least he cares something for his wife, which perhaps puts him in the less disreputable depths of the swamp. Speaking of which, there's more sewage rising to the top of the swamp on this Monday morning. Representative Devin Nunes of California joined Maria Bartiromo on Fox News Sunday Morning Futures to discuss the recent letter from Freedom Caucus members, the aforementioned Representative Mark Meadows of North Carolina, and Representative Jim Jordan of Ohio, had sent to the new Attorney General, and I guess we'll see whether this will amount to anything or not, Bill Barr. Representative Nunes noted that Attorney General Barr has until March 15th to respond to their requests concerning a couple of scumbags. How many do they need on the special counsel's team? The latest bias witch hunters to follow in the footsteps of the likes of Peter Strzok, Lisa Page, Andy McCabe, and so many others. Now it's Fixer Mueller's number two, Andrew Weissman, and a fellow named Zainab Ahmad.
So Weissman is the number two. It's Mueller's deputy. He was involved in the custody of the dossier. So in early 2016, he was given the dossier. This is somebody, him and the other individual that's mentioned there, both DOJ people, both on the Mueller team.
He's going to go through it in some detail, but these are people that are not objective, not independent, and may even have a dog in this fight.
They shouldn't be involved in this investigation. I don't know. Well, and the questions that my colleagues are asking is you know, there's clear regulations that DOJ has that, you know, you can't be conflicted. And so they're asking questions. Look, did they disclose to Mueller before Mueller picked them that they were involved in the chain of custody of this dossier? Because I will tell you, I don't know that they're going to have any, you know, criminal indictments or not. But if I was any attorney, I'd be saying, look, these people that are bringing this forward, they shouldn't be involved in this because they're biased. We already know the people that were kicked off are biased. But you also have the fact that these two individuals that Jim Jordan and Mark Meadows are asking about were involved in the chain of custody of important evidence, the dossier, the dirt from the Clinton campaign that is the basis for this entire hoax.
Wow. You know what? And if we still had a rule of law, that might be important. Specifically, though, and we'll see if it matters, the letter from Representatives Jordan and Meadows to the AG asks that they provide all documents and communications referring to or relating to disclosures made by Weissman and Ahmad as part of their appointment to the special counsel's office, and provide all documents and communications related to the process that the department used to evaluate prosecutors and investigators, sick, and their so-called independence, yeah, sure, in order to participate in the special witch hunt. On then next to the president's longest speech at the Conservative Political Action Conference on Saturday. As I've mentioned, it clocked in at just over 2 hours and 2 minutes, making it the longest of his presidency. And the speech at the annual gathering of at least so-called conservatives hit on all of his campaign topics, said Mediaite. He blasted the media, appropriately, calling them sick, whereupon he went after special counsel Robert Mueller, saying the investigations into him are bullshit. He mocked former Attorney General Do-Nothing Jeff Sessions, imitating his Alabama accent, and railed against the so-called Green New Deal, decrying Democrats as socialist, although no doubt many would say that's not a term that's far enough left for them nowadays. He even embarked, they note, on an extensive tangent about the general he says he met on his trip to Iraq, named Raisin Kane, who told him of more efficient ways to launch airstrikes in the region. And towards the end of the marathon speech, Trump touched on his recent summit with North Korean dictator Kim Jong-un in Vietnam, which ended this week with the president walking away from the table without a denuclearization deal. And he addressed the controversy he caused by defending Trump's role in the torture and death of American student Otto Warmbier, explaining he was put in, quote, a terrible position because he wanted to negotiate with Kim without insulting him, calling it a delicate balance. As quotable quotes go, this is probably your host's personal favorite. He doesn't go quite as far as I might in referring to open treason, which consists in making war against the American people, but this comes as close as he's gotten.
We have people in Congress, right now, we have people in Congress that hate our country. And you know that. And we can name every one of them if they want. They hate our country.
Yes, Mr. President, and they hate our supreme law, they hate Americans, and more than any of that, they hate the God of the Bible. There's also a bit of the usual fake news that's come out this morning. This is a disgrace, writes Jim Hoft at the Gateway Pundit. Did Reuters, again, doctor a photo from Trump at CPAC to make him look bad? Or was this something else again? Reuters, it notes, has a history of doctoring photos. Now they're doctoring photos of the president to make him look bad because he came out on stage and dared to show his love for the American flag. They actually show both photos. A reasonable-looking cut from the original video, and the selection from Yahoo Reuters by Joshua Roberts that was republished, and they provide the link so people can see it for themselves. And then you can see how many people, too, ran with the fake photo. The story does say they've reached out to Joshua Roberts for a comment, and will post an update if or when he gets back to them. Meanwhile, when it comes to fake news, doctored video, and photos, I guess we're getting used to this, whether it's the Covington Catholic High School boys or the fawning over Jussie Smollett, until that got to be too big to hide. But one thing's for sure, they're not trumping this up like they did any of the things that Alex Jones or his people posted revealing other previous whoppers, which turned out to be true. Like, you know, Jim the Accoster. Trump did say this at CPAC. Yahoo accused him of stoking fears of gun control. That could only be true if you don't understand the meaning of shall not be infringed, because he correctly stated that the Second Amendment was under siege, but then he told the audience, I'll protect you, I promise. No offense, Mr. President, but that's the point of the Second Amendment. Neither we nor the founders ultimately trust government, so we'll keep our guns. Thank you very much. And since it's obvious that there is such a concerted effort to divide Americans, those that have been dumbed down from those that actually understood once upon a time how we had a Constitution, a Bill of Rights, a rule of law, and yes, even rights that were guaranteed by the Constitution, but that came from a creator who's not only no longer welcome in the public square, but can't even be mentioned most places. Let's talk a bit about what that means. Starting with a recap of the multiple tens of trillions, but who knows, associated with the totalitarian Green New Deal that they're still pushing. Just how stupid was it, you may recall us asking, before they finally decided to deep six it, pretend it never happened, and maybe the Republicans did it anyway? And as I've already noted, Kimberly Strassel of the Wall Street Journal said, the Republican Party clearly has a secret weapon for 2020. It's especially effective because it's stealthy. And yes, it's Sandy Occasional Cortex, and all the R Party has to do is sit back and let her do the work. But that doesn't mean we shouldn't keep watching and point out the failures, increasing and obvious. Like the recent failure of socialism at Panera Bread from Boston, which, as PJ Media reminded us not too long ago, recently shuttered the last of its ideologically driven pay-what-you-want restaurants. The socialist-tinged vendors, they say, were called Panera Cares, and the higher-ups at that company have finally figured out that caring somehow doesn't seem to be synonymous with a viable business model, which puts them way ahead of Congress, at least. The last Panera Cares and Socialism Fails, closed last month. They opened the first one back in St. Louis, Missouri in 2010, championed by the company's founder, Roy Schack. The restaurant looked like a typical Panera, but offered meals at a suggested donation price with the goal of raising awareness about what they called food insecurity. And in a kind of twisted way, it actually did. In many ways, said the founder at a TED Talk later that year, this whole experiment is ultimately a test of humanity. And of socialism, I can't help but think. Would people pay for it? Would people come in and value it? Unquote. And says John Ellis for PJ Media, it appears the answer is a resounding no. There was much talk about food insecurity, which now describes those former Panera employees that don't have a paycheck and are much more food insecure as a result of socialism. So if Panera Cares had cared more about making money than a discredited, constantly refuted now ideology, its employees might still be receiving paychecks. But frighteningly enough, a growing segment of the populace seems to be allergic to common-sense economic principles. In fact, folks, I'll suggest again the reason is because they have been dumbed down and lied to about precisely that. The irony in all of this, concludes John Ellis, may be that Panera's marketing department was the one that actually cooked up Panera Cares as a way to ingratiate themselves into the heart of the leftists. You know, the Sandy Occasional Cortex and Bernie-loving social justice warrior crowd, where reality plays second fiddle to pandering. That way, they could virtue signal and eat their paninis guilt-free.
At least until along came that nasty old real world of economics.
I guess things are different if Big Brother isn't there to public-private partner with you and bail you out. The end result is the same, of course, but it takes a while longer. By the way, at this point, folks, I note this is an old concept, long discredited. It has a number of names in economic theory, including the tragedy of the commons, which basically boils down to something that supposedly belongs to everybody, ends up being taken care of by nobody. And once, before indoctrination became far more important than education, all of this was part of the standard curriculum, along with other historic examples, like the near death of the Pilgrims at Plymouth Rock, who darn near starved to death during the first winter of their failed socialist experiment as a result of a similar discredited ideology. Fortunately for them, they figured out the truth before it ended up killing them all.
Now, in sad contrast, we have things like the NewYorkMag.com asking, when did everyone, well, everyone who matters anyway, become a socialist? And I wish I was kidding.
Which brings me to the next story in this sad sequence, arguably even more dramatic, courtesy of Michael Snyder at the end of The American Dream. It's entitled Rats, Public Defecation, and Open Drug Use. Our major Western cities are becoming uninhabitable hellholes. And he left out the fact that they're also progressive, socialist, anti-scripture, anti-Christian, anti-God hellholes. Almost everyone, he begins, that goes out to visit one of our major cities on the left coast has a similar reaction. Those that must live among the escalating decay are often numb to it. But most of those that are just in town for a visit are absolutely shocked by all of the trash, human defecation, crime, and public drug use that they encounter. Once upon a time, our beautiful Western cities were the envy of the rest of the world. But now they serve as shining examples of America's accelerating decline. And for those with eyes to see, the causes behind them. The worst parts of our major Western cities, he says, look like post-apocalyptic wastelands, with the hordes of zombified homeless people that live in those areas simply too drugged out to care. The ironic thing is that these cities are not poor, at least not yet. In fact, San Francisco and Seattle are among the wealthiest cities in the entire nation. So he asks, if things are falling apart this dramatically now, just how bad will things get when economic conditions really start to deteriorate? And let's begin our look, he says, at the deterioration with the rat epidemic in Los Angeles. Thanks to, and I guess I have to say it, piss-poor sanitation, rats are breeding like mad, and at this point, they've even conquered Los Angeles City Hall, where officials are considering ripping up all the building's carpets, as rats and fleas are said to be running riot in the hallways. There's been a typhus outbreak downtown. One city employee contracted the deadly bacterial disease at work. And now the council president is urging officials to investigate the scope of the long-running pest problem. Maybe they really ought to take a broader look at the pest infestation there.
People from all over the world, says Michael Snyder, are drawn to Los Angeles because of what they've seen on television. But it truly is a filthy, filthy place. The number of homeless has been rising at about 20% annually. Public drug use is seemingly everywhere, including the now rat-infested red carpets, it would seem. And there are mountains of trash all over the place. Needless to say, rats thrive in such an environment. And the battle is so epic that a journalist recently wrote about it for the L.A. Times. Quote, East side, west side, north, south, they're everywhere. If you're a rat, the California housing crisis hasn't hit you yet, and it never will. And from there, folks, it gets downright disgusting. With graphic descriptions from the gardens, where they ate everything, to the bedrooms. And the epidemic extends to the entire left coast. There was even a massive rat infestation noted that forced authorities to close a shockingly filthy homeless encampment under a bridge in Salem, Oregon, where an outreach worker for the Salvation Army said, "It's badder than people can imagine." And anxious not to be left behind, the progressive socialist sanctuary city of Denver, Colorado, is accelerating their efforts to encourage public defecation. They've recently decriminalized a whole lot of things that once would have been taboo in a polite, honest, God-fearing, well, halfway clean society. The big rats are certainly there already, and the hordes of smaller, four-footed ones will soon follow. Which leads us now to the capo de tutte pupo for public defecation, San Francisco. Now world famous, not for the Golden Gate Bridge or leaving your heart there, but leaving your human poop there that constantly litters their streets. During one seven-day stretch last summer, writes Snyder, a total of 16,000 official complaints were submitted to the city about human feces. Once a great place to visit, that's no longer the case. Reporter John Stossel recently visited the city by the bay and was stunned, writing, San Francisco is a pretty good place to hang out with a sign. People are rarely arrested for vagrancy, aggressive panhandling, or going to the bathroom in front of people's homes. In 2015, and that's an old figure note, there were 60,491 complaints to police, but only 125 people arrested. Public drug use, of course, is generally ignored. One woman told us, quote, it's nasty seeing people shoot up right in front of you. Police don't do anything about it. They'll get somebody for drinking a beer, but walk right past people using needles, unquote. And then, of course, they leave those on the streets, too, right there in the piles of poop. And as anybody who's not dumbed down on the progressive left knows, if you subsidize something, you inevitably get more of it. San Francisco gave out 5.8 million free drug syringes in 2018. And despite spending almost $2 million last year to retrieve the needles, they still handed out a couple million more than they got back. Guess where they ended up? That's the tragedy of the commons for you. Stossel noted that each day in San Francisco, on average, about 85 cars are broken into. So Inside Edition ran a test to see how long stereo equipment might last in a parked car. Engineers call that the half-life, folks. The test car was quickly broken into, but then the camera crew discovered that their own car had been busted into as well. Bill Blaine, too, recently visited the city and was so horrified, he wrote, "The squalor we saw in the city was frightful. San Francisco had always been one of my favorite U.S. cities, but the degree of homelessness, mental illness, and drug use we saw on this trip was truly shocking. We saw sights," he said, "walking around we couldn't believe." And even though it's one of the richest cities in the world, home to 4 of the 10 richest people on the planet, according to Wiki, locals shrug off the squalor. Quote, "The city has always attracted the homeless, they say, because of the mild weather. It's a drug thing. It's not too difficult. You get used to it." And you figured Mike Snyder would eventually get around to noting that as California goes, so goes the country, is the old saying. And if that's true, we are in a whole heap of trouble. But you'd think that the lessons of history, and most recently and dramatically, Venezuela, would be taken to heart. But then again, that requires somebody to pay attention to history, or economics, or even take a look at the bad examples, like California, that are being set for us. San Francisco, concludes the piece, is generous. It offers the street people, and there are more and more of them coming all the time, now you know why, food stamps, free shelter, train tickets, and $70 a month in cash. And given free needles, that'll buy a lot of drugs. Quote, "They're always offering resources," said one man on the street. San Francisco's just a good place to hang out. The bottom line here should be obvious. The Californication of the entire country is what the progressive socialist ideal are really all about.
Keep your eyes open and don't keep silent, because it's coming to a head. And may Yahuwah bless you and yours.